Welcome to this podcast, which is brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. Today, I will talk about six of the presentations that were held during the Heart Failure Congress of this year, held from the 21st to the 24th of May.
Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
So the first topic I would like to talk about is istaroxime in patients with pre-cardiogenic shock. These are results of the SEISMIC trial, and they were presented by Professor Marco Metra of the University of Brescia in Italy. Istaroxime was designed to improve both systolic contraction and diastolic relaxation, clarified Professor Marco Metra. The current randomized double-blind placebo-controlled pilot study named SEISMIC included 60 patients with Society for Cardiovascular Angiography and Interventions Stage B cardiogenic shock and assessed efficacy and safety of 24-hour infusion of istaroxime in this population. The primary endpoint was a change in the area under curve, AUC, for systolic blood pressure, SBP, over 6 hours. Patients on istaroxime had a significantly larger increase in SBP, AUC, over 6 hours, compared to placebo. After withdrawal from istaroxime, the SBP of patients who had received this agent returned to the level of placebo receivers. The investigators did not observe differences in heart rate alterations between patients in the experimental arm and those in the placebo arm, nor was there any evidence of an adverse effect of istaroxime on renal function. Furthermore, echocardiographic parameters displayed a benefit of istaroxime over placebo, including cardiac index change from baseline, left ventricle and diastolic volume, and left atrium area. In total, 6 serious adverse events were reported per study group. Adverse drug reactions occurred in 52% of the patients, mostly being gastrointestinal complaints or infusion site pain. Notably, serious AEs occurred only in patients receiving 1.5 micrograms per kilo per minute, but not in patients receiving only 1 microgram per kilo per minute, while the hemodynamic effects of istaroxime were similar. This study supports the continuance of the development of istaroxime as a potential treatment for both acute heart failure and cardiogenic shock, concluded Professor Metra. Next, I would like to talk about GALACTIC-HF, which is testing omecamtiv mecarbil in patients with HFrEF and low systolic blood pressure. These results were also presented by Professor Marco Metra. Patients with HFrEF and low systolic blood pressure, SBP, are at increased risk of clinical events and do not tolerate guideline-directed medical therapy well, explained Professor Marco Metra. Omecamtiv mecarbil is a selective cardiac myosin activator that improves cardiac function without reducing blood pressure. Therefore, this agent may be useful in these patients. Professor Metra and colleagues analyzed the efficacy and safety of omecamtiv mecarbil in patients with HFrEF and low SBP, below 100 millimeters mercury, who were enrolled in the GALACTIC-HF trial. The primary analysis of this trial showed a significant benefit of omecamtiv mecarbil over placebo in time to first HF event or cardiovascular death in the overall population, with an HR of 0.92 and a p-value of 0.025. The current sub-analysis showed that patients with a low SBP had a higher risk of HF events than patients with an SBP above 100 millimeters mercury, HR 1.05. per 5 millimeters mercury, with a p-value below 0.001. However, the treatment effect of omecamtiv mecarbil on cardiovascular death or time to first heart failure event was numerically larger in those with a low SBP, HR 0.81, than in those with a higher SBP, HR 0.95. The p-value for interaction was 0.051. Furthermore, the safety profiles of omecamtiv mecarbil and placebo were similar in both SBP groups. Thus, the authors concluded that the challenging population of patients with HFrEF and low SBP may benefit from treatment with omecamtiv mecarbil. So the next study aimed to assess whether transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy should be added to the differential diagnosis of patients with heart failure. The results were presented by Dr. Rocío Ruiz Hueso of the University Hospital of Virgen Macarena in Spain. Dr. Rocío Ruiz Hueso and colleagues aim to assess the prevalence of cardiac amyloidosis, CA, in patients who had heart failure, HF, and were treated at the internal medicine departments of Spanish hospitals. They also compared patient profiles between those whose HF was caused by CA and those with another cause of HF. The observational prospective cross-sectional multicenter study included 453 patients with HF older than 65 years who displayed left ventricular hypertrophy. In total, 91 patients were diagnosed with CA following the CA diagnostic algorithm of the ESC Working Group on Myocardial and Pericardial Diseases, resulting in a prevalence of 20.1% of the patients with CA. 84.6% had transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy, ATTR-CM, whereas only 1.1% had primary amyloidosis. According to Dr. Ruiz Hueso, it was not possible to diagnose the CA type of the remaining 14.3% of the patients. At least 5.2% of the patients with ATTR-CM had a hereditary cause of the condition. Furthermore, patients who were diagnosed with AC were generally older and were more likely to be men. Also, patients with CA displayed higher rates of spinal stenosis, pericardial effusion, and aortic regurgitation, showed higher levels of NT-proBNP and troponin T high sensitivity, and had a higher average left ventricular mass index. Dr. Ruiz Hueso concluded that ATTR-CM should be included in the differential diagnosis of internal medicine patients with HF and myocardial thickening, irrespective of left ventricular ejection fraction. However, to establish the CA subtype correctly, invasive testing is needed when the results from non-invasive CA testing are inconclusive. Also, genetic tests are required if a patient is diagnosed with ATTR-CM. Another interesting study assessed the applicability of cardiac contractility modulation therapy in patients with HFpEF. The results of the trial, named CCM-HFpEF, were presented by Professor Cecilia Linde of the Karolinska University Hospital in Sweden. Cardiac contractility modulation therapy, or CCM therapy, has demonstrated to be efficacious in patients with heart failure, HF, and reduced or mid-range ejection fractions, mentioned Professor Cecilia Linde. The current prospective multicenter CCM-HFpEF pilot study aimed to assess the efficacy and safety of CCM in patients with symptomatic HFpEF. The primary efficacy endpoint was a mean change in Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire overall summary score through week 24, whereas the primary safety endpoint was the number of device-related and procedure-related complications. After 24 weeks, CCM therapy was associated with a mean improvement of 18.0 points on the KCCQ overall summary score, with a p-value below 0.001. Similarly, the mean change in KCCQ clinical summary score from baseline was 15.3 points. As for safety, three procedure-related complications were reported in three patients, and no device-related complications were observed after 24 weeks, resulting in an event-free rate of 93.6%. In addition, only two patients experienced one or more heart failure hospitalizations during the study, which lasted 168 days, compared with 15 patients in the year before CCM was administered. In conclusion, CCM therapy may offer improvements in the health status of patients with symptomatic HFpEF. However, further studies are needed to establish the efficacy and safety of CCM therapy in the HFpEF population. Thank you. Next, I would like to discuss results from the DAPA-HF trial. Dr. Jawad Heider-Butt from the Copenhagen University Hospital in Denmark assessed whether dapagliflozin is safe and efficacious in frail patients. Heart failure, HF, and frailty often coexist, said Dr. Jawad Heider-Butt. Since frail patients may experience more adverse drug reactions, physicians are often reluctant to introduce new therapies to frail patients. The DAPA-HF trial randomized 4,744 patients with HF and an ejection fraction below 40% to placebo or dapagliflozin. In this population, dapagliflozin added to guideline-recommended therapies reduced the risk of major cardiovascular events and improved heart failure symptoms. The current analysis assessed the efficacy and safety of dapagliflozin in patients with HFrEF from the DAPA-HF trial according to frailty status. A 32-item frailty index was conducted based on medical history, vital signs, lab data, and quality of life measures to stratify patients into not frail, more frail, and most frail. No interaction effect between frailty status and the efficacy of dapagliflozin was observed in the primary outcome, which was a composite of cardiovascular death and worsening heart failure. The p-interaction value was 0.87. The corresponding hazard ratios were 0.72 in the not frail group, 0.77 in the more frail group, and 0.71 in the frailest group. However, greater absolute reductions were reported in the frailest group, with a reduction of 7.9 events per 100 person years, compared with the more frail group, which had a reduction of 3.6 events per 100 person years, and the not frail group had a reduction of 3.5 events per 100 person years. Furthermore, the analysis revealed that quality of life improvements after 8 months of dapagliflozin treatment, as assessed by the Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire Total Symptom Score, were present in all frailty groups, but that frailer patients had significantly larger improvements on this outcome measure. The p-interaction value was 0.001. Finally, frailty status did not significantly influence the rate of adverse events-driven treatment discontinuations of dapagliflozin compared with placebo. P-interaction value was 0.37. This indicates that dapagliflozin was well tolerated regardless of frailty status. Dr. Butt concluded that dapagliflozin is safe and efficacious in patients with HFrEF regardless of the level of frailty, informing clinicians on the applicability of this agent in frail patients. Finally, I would like to talk about the REBALANCE-HF trial, which displayed encouraging results of GSN ablation in patients with HFpEF. The results were presented by Dr. Marat Fudim of the Duke Cardiology Clinic in the USA. The splanchnic bed is the main blood volume reservoir of the body, outlined Dr. Marat Fudim. Since the activation of the sympathetic nervous system, SNS, recruits blood from this reservoir into the central circulating volume, which leads to elevation of filling pressure, ablation of the greater splanchnic nerve, GSN, may redistribute this blood to the periphery and relieve the symptoms of patients with HFpEF. The REBALANCE-HF study is currently randomizing patients with HFpEF to right-sided GSN ablation or a sham procedure to analyze the efficacy and safety of this procedure. The primary endpoint is a change in pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, PCWP, at 1 month, in rest, with legs up, and during 20 watt and peak exercise intensity. Additionally, 1 to 2 open-label roll-in patients were included at each site. Dr. Fudim presented a first analysis and preliminary data of this roll-in cohort. 1 month post-GSN ablation, the mean PCWP was significantly improved during 20 watts exercise and peak exercise. There was no significant difference between the mean resting state PCWP at baseline and 1 month, or with legs up. Notably, New York Heart Association functional class had improved by at least one class in 33% of the patients after 1 month, and KCCQ overall score was increased by an average 22.1 points. The 6-minute walk test and NT-proBNP levels had not improved after the ablation procedure. Concerning safety, 3 non-serious device-related adverse events were reported, with 1 case of acute heart failure decompensation, 1 case of transient hypertension during the procedure, and 1 patient experiencing back pain after ablation. Although these preliminary results are promising, more data is needed before this approach can be applied in the real world. The randomized part of the Rebalance HF will provide more information on the efficacy and safety of this ablation procedure in patients with HFpEF.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.